10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg, next.
Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. More information at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg.
Well, that is an enticing way to begin this morning show, for sure. That is the opening to the third piano sonata of one of history's greatest composers, Johannes Brahms. And this is the opening of just one of the pieces that is going to be part of an extraordinary undertaking by Dr. Wael Farouk, who is a brand new member to the music faculty here at Carthage. And he is undertaking what is being called the Brahms Project, a 15-month project in which he will be essaying essentially all of the piano music of Brahms, not only the music for piano, but also the chamber pieces that involve piano with other instruments. It's an extraordinary body of superlative music, and what a privilege it will be for all of us to be able to encounter it. And I'm very, very pleased that my colleague has made time in his schedule to have this chat, to talk about Mr. Brahms and his music for piano, and to entice all of you to take in the first performance from this series, the Brahms Project, which will be this coming Friday evening.
The first solo concert, correct, will be Friday the 24th. However, the chamber concert will be kicking off the series this Saturday.
Right. 18th. Oh, this Saturday night. This Saturday night will be the this chamber concert featuring a trio and two of his solo sonatas. So, anyway, Dr. Wael Farouk, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you very much for the lovely introduction. I really appreciate it.
So, first of all, have you ever done something like this before? That is, an extensive project over the course of many months involving all or nearly all of the piano music of a given composer?
Actually, I did back in 2013 when I did all Rachmaninoff's cycle. It encompassed all of his solo music. There was no chamber this time, but all of his works in five recitals.
So, did anything in particular prompt you to choose Johannes Brahms and to kick off this Brahms project? Are you drawn to him for any particular reason?
Well, to be honest, you don't need a real particular reason to be drawn to his wonderful music, as you know, but I thought, since I like taking on projects like that, but especially with Brahms's chamber music, which to me is at least equal of an accomplishment and in its greatness to his solo music. Some of these works, in my humble opinion, even surpasses his solo works. So I thought it would be a wonderful way to start my years here at Carthage was collaborating with other faculty, other colleagues, other friends. So, as you know, we formed the Carthage Trio and we started performing in the fall. There were no Brahms then, but going through this incredibly rich output of his chamber music, I thought it would be a great way for us to collaborate together and, you know, make music here at this wonderful space.
It might be good for you to say a word about Brahms and kind of the interesting place he has in music history as someone who lived and worked during the Romantic period, and yet who was not exactly a romantic composer in the same way that some of his contemporaries, such as Wagner or Liszt, were extraordinarily romantic. Explain the way in which Brahms is, in a sense, a bit of a mixture in terms of the kind of music he composed and what was important to him.
Sure. He was, in many ways, in a tough spot, if I may say. He was kind of predicted to be Beethoven descendant, and, you know, people like Schumann and his wife Clara, and even Franz Liszt earlier on, were extremely impressed by him and thought, you know, he is going to give music back what it had lost since Beethoven's death, and hence the title Dr. Brahms, right, because he's going to refix and put back music in a healthier shape again. However, I think, and more than just think, based on some studies and reading of his letters and some other people's letters, and also going through his music, it took him a while to find his own tone a little bit. However, I find it very fascinating, his earlier works, or his first works, like Opus 1 and Opus 2 and Opus 5, the three sonatas, and then his later works. There is something interesting between these two. The first three main works, the piano sonatas, are so extremely passionate, so extremely romantic, so extremely Listian, if you want to call them that. They're all over the keyboard. They spare no means of economy at all, and they use the keyboard in ways that you don't see almost at all in his later works, Opus 116, 17, 18, 19. Not to say that the later works are less passionate or less romantic. Of course not. They're more so heartbreaking in many ways. However, they are very, very economic in their use. In my, again, humble opinion, I feel like every composer is really a romantic. Bach is a romantic. Mozart is a romantic. However, what language they choose to communicate and architect their work through, that's when we started classifying them. To me, there is no question that Brahms is, you know, an absolute romantic. And actually, he was much more on terms with the Liszt school, or even the Wagnerian school, than people think. I think their disciples or their students started separating these two streams. And, you know, I am the Brahms Joachim school, I am the Liszt Wagnerian school. Well, Brahms loved all kinds of music. Of course, his gods were Bach, Schubert, and Beethoven, and Mozart, but he also attended Carmen 20-so times, and he predicted that this will be the most famous opera, which is, you know, true. And there is also the incident, which I'm sure you know, of a lady asking him to autograph a score, and the only thing she had at the time was the Fledermaus. And he wrote, Leute nicht Brahms, unfortunately not by Brahms, because he liked the opera very much. So
he wished he had written it.
Exactly. He had a great sense of humor. There is so many elements of gypsy music in his works, and there is so many elements of dance music, and so many elements of free form, and he liked to be viewed, or I think to have his place in history, more of the classical tradition, which is true, but also his works and his language and the context of his music is no argument for me, at least, that it's an absolute romantic.
Just say a quick word about what it means to prepare all of this music. It reminds me of the folks who go into the field of actuary science, who have to take a kind of follow a gauntlet of huge exams that are months apart, and it's so different from what most of them have ever experienced as students, where on Friday I have a test, and then I have a paper, and then I have a test, and so on. But it's a gauntlet that stretches over time. Now, for you, this BOMS project, again, will be over the course of 15 months. So in terms of preparing all of this music and polishing it, I suppose much of it you've played, maybe all of it you've played before, but what is involved in mounting it from that sort of preparatory point of view?
Well, actually, I have not performed any of them in public. I studied several. I performed the two concerti in public, which ironic because they are very... it's a lot of Brahms, especially these two concertos. Each is about an hour, and even though many people place them as the height of Brahms's output, which is true, I felt much more at ease with them than starting by other solo works to perform first. So I went it kind of the other way by playing those big works, which in other ways made the solo or the smaller works to be more accessible to me, at least. Funny how that works sometimes. But anyhow, so there is, as you mentioned, the learning process, which you have to, you know, stay home and read the music and memorize it and polish it, assign fingering, pedaling, all of that. But then, of course, there is the practical experience, which is putting it to practice and performing it and practice the performance process itself. It's not like a test. As you said, you just sit down and you put the exact answers and that's it. And on the stage there's so many variables that one cannot predict, but we try to prepare for as well as we can to reduce any sense of disaster that might appear. But I think it's the same as preparing any other work, really, or any other recital or a chamber recital. It's just happened to be condensed body of music, but I know his music very well, even though I have not performed much of it in public. I know it very well, and I'm not comfortable at all performing anything on the stage that I have not lived with for the acceptable amount of time, which is, you know, relative from a performer to performer. But I have to be sure first that I know the music in and out, that I able to play it, not just to present it. I have to have something to say about it, otherwise what's the point? So but choosing the project also, we were lucky in terms of numbers and years and anniversaries. 2017 marks the 120th anniversary in his death. The very last concert, which is May 7th of 2018, is Brahms' actual birthday, where he is 185 years old. And it will be a great closing concert. We are having the world-renowned Ilya Kalar, an amazing violinist who won the Tchaikovsky competition. He'll be performing with us. We're going to have two outstanding students will play with us one sonata movement by Brahms, Mary Kelly and Schutze, and of course the trio will play on the same concert as well. So it will be a festive festivus ending for this festival. So
marvelous. So we want to remind people that this Saturday night is the kickoff of the Brahms project with a recital that will feature one of his trios and two of his solo sonatas. And then the following Friday night is the first piano solo recital. I know that in addition to the third sonata, you're going to be playing two different sets of variations. His variations on a theme of Paganini. Correct. And his variations on a theme by Handel. You're going to give us a little brief sample of one of the variations from the Handel variations. Anything you want to say?
Well, briefly, as you mentioned earlier about him wanting to be more of a classical composer, I think these are one of the mediums he chose to write in, which were very much associated with classical composers, Bach, Mozart, and Beethoven, the forms of variations. Many of his contemporaries, Liszt, for example, or even Schumann, or Chopin either wrote very, very, very little in that form, or none at all. So, but he thrived in that form, and I think he thrived in the medium where there are lots of possibilities and lots of angles. Variations, as you very well know, is just looking at one item with a kaleidoscope type of thing. You're seeing it from every single possibility, extracting every single musical possibility, thematic possibilities, architecture possibilities, so on and so forth. So these are perhaps his most famous works in the genre, and in a way most taxing in terms of structure and length as well.
So here is just a little bit of the fifth variation from the Handel Variations of Brahms. Absolutely exquisite music by Johannes Brahms and played exquisitely. So again, this Saturday night, the first concert in the Brahms project here in Siebert Chapel, I assume, and the following Friday night, the first of the solo piano recitals that we part of the Brahms project, this 15-month project, which will eventually come to an end in May of 2018. Dr. Wael Farouk, my thanks to you for joining me today on The Morning Show, and best wishes.
Thank you so much. I'm honored. Thanks.
And while we're on the topic of Johannes Brahms, here is a very special treat. On December 2nd, 1889, Brahms, one of history's most legendary composers, sat down in front of one of the primitive recording devices that had just been invented by Thomas Alva Edison. And Brahms recorded himself playing his own Hungarian Dance No. 1 after introducing himself. The amount of background noise is enormous, but if one listens carefully through the din, one can just make out the voice of Johannes Brahms and his playing. A recording made by the legendary Johannes Brahms on December 2nd, 1889. One more reminder that the Brahms Project at Carthage College begins this weekend with a Saturday evening concert in Siebert Chapel and the following Friday as well. And you can go to carthage.edu and find the section of the website called The Bridge and find more information about this sprawling Brahms project. My thanks again to Dr. Wael Farouk for joining me for part one of today's morning show here on WGTD. Part two is coming up in just a moment. The time is 8:29. This is WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. This portion of WGTD's morning show is devoted to, in a sense, the scenario of the Brady Bunch, or closer to our own age, a certain storyline in Modern Family, namely the blending of families, the step-parenting challenge, which does not get talked about enough, although it is certainly a reality for more and more families. And a very thoughtfully crafted book has just been written called Blending Families, Merging Households with Kids 8 to 18. And I'm going to be speaking with one of the two authors of the book, Trevor Crowe Mulineaux, who is a licensed marriage and family therapist and a co-author of an earlier book called Forging Healthy Connections. In this new book, Blending Families, she and her co-author explore a number of different ways in which step-parenting can be a tremendous challenge and also a tremendous blessing, incredibly fulfilling and satisfying and joyous. But it is not always, in fact, maybe not often, an easy, effortless path. And they have included many real-life examples and stories about step-parents. And Trevor Crowe Mulineaux herself has some first-hand experience when it comes to the challenges of step-parenting. And I'm very excited to have this opportunity to speak about this book, which is published by Roman and Littlefield. Trevor Crowe Mulineaux, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg.
Could you say a word first about your own experience, firsthand experience, in the realm of step-parenting, having both been a step-parent and having been step-parented, so to speak?
You are absolutely correct. So I met my kid's dad, and he had two children, one who is now 27. At the time, she was six, and her little brother was three. So we went on to have two children together. So my kids have half-siblings. Unfortunately, that relationship ended. However, I remarried a wonderful, wonderful man, and he has a daughter who's actually graduating today from the Hopkins School here in Connecticut. And so I've blended not only one, but two families, and my children currently have a stepsister, and they have half-siblings. So it's a little complicated.
Right. And one of the things I appreciate about your book is that this is not just a book about I did this perfectly, and so here's how you do it. This is a story that acknowledges a more complicated reality, not only for yourself, but for all these other people that you also talk about who have grappled with the really special challenges of being a step-parent.
Yes, it is. It has its highs and lows, like any other family group. But this is particularly tricky. And if you really walk into it with eyes wide open and knowing that there are alliances just naturally with your biological child, and it's hard to create relationships with step or half sibs, it's really something you have to step into with thinking about it. Wanting to be curious, very open-hearted, and with a lot of love and patience. And a little humor helps, too.
I'm really glad that on the second page of the book, you grab hold of what I think some people are kind of sheepish about discussing, and namely what you were just saying, that there is a difference between the relationship between a biological parent and their biological child and a step-parent and their stepchild, right from the beginning, on a sort of fundamental animal way, is the way that you say it. In fact, you describe the way in which your first child, your own biological child, you tell us, smelled like flowers to me.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something you tell us that is, in a sense, hardwired for the typical parent. And that is something, of course, that is not going to exist in quite the same way with even the most loving, devoted step-parent.
Absolutely. And, you know, that is part of the challenge and the complicated nature of all this, and also the feeling of great joy and love when you create a relationship with a child that you aren't biologically, you know, there is no DNA connection, yet we all can show up for each other. And how wonderful if we look at it from the stepchild's perspective of, here's yet another adult who wants to love me and show up for me and listen and, you know, help with the resources, whether it's time or money or just, you know, watching the lacrosse game to feel like people are caring about me. So I really feel like it's made me grow as a person. I love my family and that all of these kids, whether they're related by blood or not, do literally show up for each other. Right now at this graduation, I've got the 27-year-old at the 17-year-olds, and there's no blood between these two, but they're sisters, and they really do care about each other. So this is what I think, even though we're hardwired for this sort of animal connection, if we mindfully walk into the blending situation with this sort of love and patience and understanding that it's some work, and it's not, maybe not a natural connection. It's something you have to try for, but it can be really great, and it's very rewarding, actually.
Right. I think that's one reason why at one point in the author's note, you call it the blending adventure. and probably for somebody who's grappling with maybe the harsher realities of it, or maybe trying to blend under less than ideal circumstances, it might not feel like an adventure. But in fact, this is what it can be, especially when it's done well. In addition to being a step parent yourself in a couple of different scenarios, you have also been, in a sense, step parented. And I wonder if you could just say a word about what you saw in the relationship between your own mother and the man that she later married when you were in your mid-20s, a man named Howard Stevenson. It sounds like you've taken great inspiration from the way in which they step-parented.
Mm-hmm. And they continue to do so, by the way. They've been together, 27, 28 years now. And they're a brilliant role model for me. And both Howard and my mom have been so loving. We really do have a Brady Bunch. There's four of us girls. And then my mom married Howard, who had three sons. We all never lived in the same house at the same time, but the two youngest, my younger sister and his youngest son, Andy, spent much more time in the house. What I saw and what I learned and I still take inspiration from today is the two of them made their couple the focus and the strong boundaried foundation for the whole story. And they were very careful to be as fair as possible, as loving as possible, and giving us resources again, whether it's money or time or advice. And they strived for that every step of the way. And, it, you know, of course, none of these things are ever perfect. But what they did really, really well is they never undermined each other. They always, you know, if you asked a question or pushed, you know, my biological mom on something, she always was like, nope, Howard and I are on a team. We're not going to separate on this. This is a decision we made together. So to me, that's the strongest, best way to start the blend, is it's really got to be in a couple where you love each other and you're just, you've got to, and this is a really tough thing to say, and a lot of people kind of wince when I say it, but you actually have to choose your spouse over your biological child over time. Because in the end, our kids are supposed to leave, just like any family, you know, whether it's an intact biological family or not. And we're forgetting, I think, especially in our culture today, that the couple, we need to nurture our relationship together, us one-on-one, two together, and then the children will all be safer, stronger, connected. If there's sort of this bringing the child up into the parental subsystem, it gets very waffly and unsafe and frankly dangerous. And it's not good for the child. It's not good for the couple. So my parents really did that. There really has been a hierarchy. You know, we're a team. You kids are not going to come between us, but we're going to show up when we can and the best we can and in a very loving way. So that's been a great role model and really truly has been set the stage for the way I've viewed and helped, you know, create these three families that I've been working with.
We're speaking
and written the book on.
We're speaking with Trevor Crowe Molino about her book, Blending Families, Merging Households with Kids 8 to 18. You say as the introduction opens that in a sense you choose to become a step-parent in a way that becoming a biological parent is not always quite the same clear choice. I mean, obviously to some extent, most of the time there is
some element of choice involved. But in your words, step-parenting reflects a conscious decision to form a family with children whose personalities you didn't help shape when they are little. Mm-hmm. They are children who do not have your genes. There is a lot you don't know about them physically, emotionally, and psychologically. In so many ways, they are strangers. Mm-hmm. I really appreciate the frankness with which you say that as well, because that's a reality that probably a lot of people in writing books like this probably are tempted to sort of dance around. And maybe mm-hmm. people who live through this reality are also tempted to kind of dance around that reality. Strikes me as much healthier to sort of take that reality head on and be honest about it right from the start.
Well, thank you for that. And I did want to be really clear about this, that this is not a Pollyanna story, and it's very tricky and difficult for many, many people. And I've counseled families who are really coping with some difficult issues. But I do want it to be a very hopeful book, hopeful from the perspective of love is elastic. And as we show love to one another and we create a sense of safe haven in our homes where everyone belongs, everybody feels safe, everybody feels seen and heard and valued, that you actually create a great deal of healing for all of those individuals. And remember, when you're starting a blend, it's always from loss, whether a parent has died or there's been a divorce or a parent just abandoned or just never showed up. So there's a lot of healing that needs to happen. And if you can step into this whole story with this sort of sense of, yeah, you may not know these children, but if you give them a chance to grow and thrive and love them and show you you really care and you're curious, I really believe that we can create these little tiny communities that can be so powerful and warm and loving. And that's really, to me, the rewarding and great point of all this.
Hmm. The first part of the book, called Opportunities and Challenges, includes an exploration of different kinds of attachment styles. Mm-hmm. And this is really, really interesting, and it includes a questionnaire that you invite the reader to take. And the way we answer these 10 questions can help us understand what our own attachment style might be. And I hasten to add that one's attachment style might be different in terms of your attachment style with your romantic partner versus your attachment style with, for instance, your children or your stepchildren. Explain this notion of attachment style, the different possibilities that are there, and why it's so important for us to know this about ourselves if we are about to embark on the adventure of step-parenting.
Well, we all develop an attachment style in 0 to 2 when our caregiver showed up for us or didn't. And given the nature of our own personalities, the environment, and how that person was responsive to us, we create, it could be a secure attachment, so you're healthy and secure within yourself. You could be anxious, which is you're always pursuing, you're never quite satisfied, you get very reactive if people don't reassure you. Or you can be an avoidant, have an avoidant attachment style, which means you really push your emotions down. You don't really identify what's really happening. You tend to step away. You freeze or flee when things are happening. You kind of go numb, and you can't really be responsive because your own feelings have been so, pushed down inside you. So that's an avoidant. And then the last attachment style is called chaotic. It's both of those things, the anxious and the avoidant coming together, which is, we call it come to me, go away. So if you're parenting from one of these attachment styles other than secure, if your child, if you're an anxious parent, for example, and your child is like pushing you away, trying to be a little bit more independent, saying, look, I need to go meet with my friends, and I'm developing my feeling of who I am out in the community, this around the 13, 14-year-old, 12-year-old adolescent stage, and an anxious parent may not really welcome that. They may feel rejected by the child or abandoned by the child, and they might pursue the child to come back and stay with them more often than they, please spend more time with me. But that's hard on the child as they're trying to create their own identity outside of the house. Now, a withdrawing, avoidant parent doesn't really talk to the child much about emotions because they're really not in touch with their own. The child might be in crisis, and the avoidant parent really doesn't have any tools to reach in and say, I see you're having trouble. Come to me. Let's talk. Let's name your emotional place so we can resolve it together. An avoidant parent has difficulty connecting that way. So if we become aware of our own attachment styles in relation to our children and in relation to our partners, we really start to understand, I am reactive in this way. I don't have to always react that way. For example, I myself tend to be more of the avoidant type. So in my mind, I have to sort of slow down and go, instead of saying, I can't deal with this anymore, I'm going to walk out, I'm going to get in my car, I'm going to drive down the street because I'm so frustrated. That's my usual style, by the way. I stop and I slow down and I tell myself, use your words. You can say right now you're getting frustrated. You can say to yourself, you can say to your child or even your spouse, I'm actually kind of overwhelmed. I don't even really know what to say. I'm having trouble dealing with this, or you start to get a little bit more vulnerable and more in touch with your own feelings, and then you bring the conversation to a very different place. Now, the reason why that is so important in a blended family situation is because emotions do get high. There are times when, for example, your spouse you feel like your spouse is aligning himself with his son or his daughter over you, and when that threat comes up, in a couple, it's very important to really voice it. And as an avoidant, normally I'd be like, oh, well, I'm not going to deal with that, or I'll go, have lunch with my friend, but now I'm trying to teach myself to say, you know what, when you do X, Y, or Z, or you parent your daughter a little differently than my kids, I need you to understand what happens, how it lands on me.
Hmm. Yeah, I have to say,
using my words.
Right. I have to say, by the way, my wife and I happen not to be parents. But as you're talking about these attachment styles, I'm realizing I would probably understand my wife and she would understand me better. And our relationship, which is very strong, very positive, would be even stronger and even more positive if we were mindful of each other's attachment styles. So I can see somebody who's not even a step-parent or even a parent at all really benefiting from maybe exploring this idea of one's own attachment style. And that could have ramifications, I suppose, even beyond marriage to and family, to the way one relates to friends and so on.
Absolutely. You're absolutely correct. And we certainly learned since the mid-90s, there's a brilliant woman named Sue Johnson who's created emotionally focused therapy for couples. It's the only well-established, well-researched, evidence-based couples therapy that really addresses these attachment styles and helps couples calm down, have compassion not only for their own reactivity, but be able to step away and kind of go, oh, I see that's happening. My wife gets, her reactivity is she gets very anxious and elevated and escalated. And I can meet her when she gets to that place. I can reassure her and say, I'm here, honey. Let's bring it down together. I can show up for you in those stressful moments. So, yes, and a lot of Sue Johnson's and attachment theory is very much influenced, my style of therapy, but also this book.
Right.
So I owe a great credit to her.
I appreciate the matrix at one point that's shared about the three main young characters in the Harry Potter books, Hermione Granger and Ron Weasley and Harry Potter, as being, in a sense, examples of secure attachment style. That would be Hermione, Ron being the anxious, ambivalent type, and Harry being a bit more avoidant. And it's kind of fun to read what you say about that. And then you go on to talk about how this can have ramifications in terms of the way one tends to parent and the way in which one's parenting is seen. Is it more valuable to be mindful of one's own attachment styles, or does one also need to think about the children and their own attachment styles as well?
Well, if you get pretty good at recognizing your own reactivity and being able to say, okay, right now I can feel myself getting, and this is actually a checking in on your physical experience, because all of our emotions register in our bodies first. If you can stop and slow down and go, oh, I feel my stomach going into knots right now. Okay, before I actually start reacting in my normal way, whether it's withdraw or yell or whatever it is you usually do, you stop and slow down and go, okay, here's where I'm at. I can take a deep breath. And then the next piece, which is, you know, it's a skill set and it takes a while. This is the 10,000 hour rule. Once you get to that place of sort of self-compassion, you can kind of check in and go, okay, what's happening with this child now? And that's important. That's a very important piece of this, which is if you know their styles and you're able to get them to understand their own stuff because you have compassion, now you have compassion for them, they learn and grow and they can handle their, again, back to this, like, emotional resiliency, we're all much stronger and healthier when we can voice what's really happening for us in this very clear, authentic, vulnerable way. And if you create that safe place for that child to speak their truth, everybody grows. And it's a great feeling. And I'm always trying to work on it because there are days when you're like just really mad at them and you're like, you did what? But if you can calm down and go, okay, so what's the context? Give me what was going on for you. Why did you make those choices? Let me listen open-heartedly to this before I go really ballistic.
Right.
It can be hard.
Right. Speaking of being hard, I really appreciate the chapter in which you explore what you see as five of the most fundamental challenges that are part of this blending families process. And boy, they make a lot of sense. Putting the couple first can be very, very tricky. Resolving parenting differences, I suppose that's parenting styles and the different choices that different parents make. Communicating stability to the children, given the fact that, as you say repeatedly, most step-parenting situations are actually born of some kind of trauma, setting the boundaries of step-parenting, and finally, establishing equality where there is inequality. I think all five of those right on the surface make a lot of sense, and of course, it's good to read about more of the details, except the last one. I think the last one is the least obvious of the five. Can you explain what the significance is of this balance between equality and inequality?
Well, one of the big issues between, you know, putting a set of siblings, step-siblings together is each of those families come from, they have different rituals, different values in many ways. And you have to celebrate the differences rather than judge the differences. So I like to call it like my stepbrothers are really great. They love kayaking and biking, and they're very much into green energy and responsible environmental sort of approach to the world. They have all these really great ideas, and I've learned a lot from them. And me and my sisters are all tend to be more, oh, we love to travel and we wear fancier clothes and we really don't go camping generally. And so we've loved and enjoyed a different kind of a style, if you will. And one of the things my parents have strived to do is say, there's differences, but there's no better. You guys aren't better than the girls or vice versa, that we celebrate those differences and we're not going to create an unequal situation. And remember, some step families come together and there can be a very giant financial difference between those two families. And so being sensitive to where your children are, how each sort of family group comes together and understanding where maybe one might feel insecure or another might feel unsure, that you're just very attuned to how those differences can manifest and reassure the kids that we're not going to pay attention to those. We're going to love you guys for who you are and celebrate and support those interests and those ambitions and drives. And cool, we're going to support that and go forward, but we're not going to set up they're better because they're, you know, vegan or something. I don't know. But the kids are hyper aware of these differences. So just being aware of that and you'll be fine.
Right. This brings to mind something that gets talked about more than once in the book. That is contrasting two different television programs that each depict blended families, but in such different fashion, namely the Brady Bunch from the late 1960s, early 70s, and of course a program that's on the air right now, Modern Family, which many of us watch and love. And maybe we watched and loved the earlier show too, but the one really pays only the slightest attention to the reality of blending two families together. I mean, most of the time it could be just two parents with six kids and what happens, you know, with boys and girls and living in the same house. But Modern Family, in a sense, takes a much more nuanced, detailed, realistic approach to just how messy this blending process can be when you have different people making different assumptions and so on. I really appreciate that because, you know, in a nutshell, it helps us understand just how complicated yet how wonderful all this can be.
Yeah, you have to embrace the mess.
Let's finish by talking about five musts to succeed: trust, vulnerability, empathy, truthfulness, and structure. And was it hard to come up with this list of five, or did they present themselves very naturally and effortlessly to you?
I think between Marianne and I, we've worked together on now two books. You know, she was saying we really need to structure this in a way and show, like, these are some very clear points that help people, you know, create a structure to build upon. And that once we started talking that way, they sort of flowed out in a really easy manner. And when those five points are in place, you can feel the strength of it. And the kids feel it, I believe, too. And that's how you, and as long as, you know, you're embracing the mess, but also being able to adapt and to listen and to care, it all comes together, and it's fine and wonderful. Yes, there's always going to be messy moments, but again, it's doable. And that's why I really want everybody to understand there's a very hopeful piece of this.
Oh, absolutely.
And
I appreciate how this part of the book really goes into some detail about each of these concepts, which we're all familiar with, but sometimes turning those terms on their head or really helping us think about them in different ways. I want to finish by asking you about something that might surprise people a little bit. It's this notion that gets said more than once that if you're right about 30% of the time, probably things are going to be okay. Tell us where that comes from.
Well, a guy named Ed Tronick has done some really wonderful research around attachment styles and parenting. And if anybody wants to look on YouTube, there's a wonderful video called Still Face Experiment, and it's heartbreaking. But take a look at it, because that works even in adult relationships when you don't when you kind of shut down and don't relate, that there's this mom and a baby and there's a dance and the mom just shuts down and the baby, you know, just can't deal with it and starts to cry and just makes you cry. But we even do this in adult relationships. Anyway, past that. I lost my train of thought.
We're talking about the 30% of the time.
Right. I'm sorry. So Ed Tronick came up with the number 33%. So we can't show up and be responsive and loving and kind 100% of the time. And so after all of the experiments that he'd been doing in his research, he discovered that really doing it well 33% of the time is fine, and that's a very forgiving number. And I love it, and I remind myself of it, because we will mess up, we will fall down, and there's something called an apology. And I believe so much in, especially as a step parent, I recently had to apologize to my stepdaughter because I did something that was really unacceptable. And just being able to say, look, I really messed up, and I'm going to do my best to do better. Those are, again, healing moments for everybody. So 33% of the time, I think, gives us all a little space to say, you know what? It's okay. You can mess up, you can apologize, and you can pick up and keep going and still build.
The book is Blending Families, Merging Households with Kids 8 to 18, published by Roman and Littlefield. One of the authors, Trevor Crowe Molyneux. Trevor Crowe Molyneux, I thank you for writing such a wonderful book and for joining me today on The Morning Show. Best wishes to you.
Thank you so much, Greg, and what a great interview. Thank you very much.
Well, tomorrow on The Morning Show, actually, we have had to reschedule because Nan Calvert's visit to The Morning Show needs to be postponed for 1 week. We look forward to a visit with Sister Janet from the Eco Justice Center and Jane Herring from here at Gateway. previewing the upcoming EcoFest. Tomorrow, instead, you're going to hear my conversation with a highly acclaimed sports writer, Bob Ryan, and his wonderful autobiography called Scribe, My Life in Sports. And on Friday, I'll be rebroadcasting for Black History Month my conversation with the author of a very, very interesting book called Giants, which explores the parallel lives of our 16th president, Abraham Lincoln, and the great black abolitionist and former slave, Frederick Douglass.